Hey everybody, so today we are joined by a special guest. Jessica is somebody that I've come across a lot on LinkedIn because she's always active. And one of the things that she was recently talking about was the proliferation of statements or claims made by research or things that look like research, smell like research, but are they research? I don't know. And if it's evidence-based, then there should be corroborating evidence or supporting evidence as to the claim, right? That's usually how this works. Except we're noticing, a lot of us in this space are noticing that that's not always the case. The hype cycle is real. So that is the topic of the conversation today. So if this sounds interesting to you, and honestly, there is so much to talk about in this space, I'm really curious what your thoughts are. So make sure you leave that in the comments below. All right. So with that, let's go get started.
So my name is Jessica and I work at Adobe. I'm a senior information architect. I've been working in the field really since 1997. Mm-hmm. And I guess it's fair to say, you know, I've worked within government, within e-commerce, a number of different roles, ed tech, ad tech, martech, like all of the techs. But most importantly, like I have a background in history. That's my undergrad, and then a master's in teaching and a master's in information and library science, all very research focused. Nice. And so I bring that into my practice.
Very nice. And you know, the inspiration behind this talk was we were going back and forth because there's a lot of stuff out there right now where, you know, a lot of claims to things, especially when it comes to AI and what it can and cannot do. And you and I started talking about how there was, I think, some study somewhere that once you got into the nitty gritty details, which I think you dug into, it was like the smallest itty bitty sample size or something that basically said that you can't really take this statement or the claims made by this as something that's going to be attributable to all other things, right? Because it wasn't a small or it wasn't a big enough sample size, right? So
yeah,
that's the question. Like, first of all, so you have a library background. So when you are thinking like information literacy kind of thing, what would you suggest are the starting points in understanding when you're reading something or when you're looking at a claim? How do you dig into, Is it well-founded? Is it very well based in evidence?
Yeah, I always look, the first things I look for, because there's many different types of research, and we hit on this a little bit, which I think we'll get into. But I always look for the hypotheses, first of all. Regardless of the type of research, I always also look at the footnotes and the sources. So any of the sources upon which the research is founded, there has to be a distribution of different types of sources.
Mm-hmm.
So you have primary sources, secondary, and tertiary, for example.
Oh boy. So you should probably define that for those that don't know.
Okay. So the primary is like, would be like in interviews. Something that is taken firsthand, it's that person's like a personal account. From a historical perspective, that's always seen in research as the closest to the truth, possibly. Mm-hmm. But it's also usually has to be substantiated by secondary, which would be those who form research and are also basing claims upon primary and secondary sources.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You get to tertiary, and it's a little further away. A tertiary source might be something like Wikidata, or Wikipedia could be considered a source.
The farther away the source and the more interpretation, the farther out you go, right?
Yes. And so it's harder to found research. Sometimes you come across research and there's pages of footnotes and pages of citations. That's great. Still, it doesn't mean it's a great paper or it's founded research, because again, you have to look at the distribution of the types of citations and
yeah.
sort.
Yeah.
That's
Yeah.
what's really important. And you have to have a critical mind. You have to use critical thinking skills to be able to understand what that research paradigm looks like.
Yeah. And I mean, it's kind of a chicken or the egg, because sometimes when you're looking at that reference list or the footnotes, or even if you're looking at something that's, taking quotes that maybe they're,
which ones are what things are being omitted from that quote, for instance. You know, there's some cherry picking that can happen, but how do you know it's being cherry picked if you don't already know the body of knowledge? So it's like, well, which one comes first, right? It's a little hard to do.
Well, in the paper that in reference, just to give some context around the research paper, there's a, like so many research papers that are coming out now that look very official, that look academic-y and look like they're peer reviewed because they follow a certain format. And it is not difficult to publish a paper that seems authoritative in that vein. The paper that I read, it was about AI. It was a claiming to have 100% accuracy reducing hallucinations.
Well, and statistically speaking, there is no way to get 100%. Like,
Well,
that's
and that would be
statistically
your first
improbable.
warning. That is your first warning sign. So the title and the claims, and everyone on LinkedIn was so excited, was like, wow, this paper. And so then I was like, let me see what the wow in this paper is. And saw the hypotheses, okay. And then saw the research questions and saw the prompts. So most of the AI type papers will also include prompts, for example. Nowhere in the paper did it have what the sources or the training data was like what shaped or formed the training data. It simply had prompts. Like if you are blindly just executing prompts against AI, but you don't specify how that AI has been trained.
Well,
What
maybe
the
they don't know though, right? Like, I mean, if you're using OpenAI, just like the free open version, you might not know, right?
Sure. But what's interesting, and I understand the don't know, but I went ahead and I Googled each of the prompts because they seemed very library-ish. The prompts were strict, like almost Wikipedia subject pages. And so when I Googled those prompts, they came up, of course, with Wikipedia as the first result, almost verbatim. The prompts themselves you could find within the text of these Wikipedia pages. You know, another thing with research is that you have to have a nice distribution to balance research. So you have to challenge your own research by not only confirming your own biases. Confirmation bias is everywhere in research or not within research, but you have to distribute and fairly distribute your research to also give fair play to what could disqualify your research to
Well, and the
test.
counter arguments, right? Like you have
Okay.
to say who
Of course.
argues against what you're saying.
I mean, that's critical thinking 101 is you. When you form an argument that you always have to think of the other side of the argument and cover that other side of the argument and state your claim for why your claim, which may not agree or confirm the other side of the argument, but it helps to substantiate your own research. And I think that's a big part of what we're starting to miss. You know, and the other part of research is quantitative, a distribution of quantitative and qualitative data, with that principle being lost. It's very difficult to stand on your research or to feel comfortable with your claims or hypotheses if you don't distribute your sources, if you don't have a nice distribution between quantitative and qualitative data. And the reason why there are things like FAIR data is the idea of sharing research so we don't repeat each other's research, but the idea of building upon each other's research. So it does not hurt your research. You may be the first in show, the first piece of art that's testing, you know, a certain thought or a hypothesis or idea. That's fine. But usually in those, if you're the first one out of the gate to even think about or ever look at a concept or an idea or a research challenge, then great. But usually in the conclusion, that's going to prompt more curiosity, more research questions that you open up to the community. And you also state, and this is something that needs to be researched further to confirm. This is not a one and done. Like, we need more research in this area to substantiate what I've discovered as a
Well, and
review.
even to that point, right? Like, so if you are saying I am the first one to do this potato exercise, well, you have to go and look at the rest of the research body to even assert that claim, right? So back to your original point about, you have to make sure that when you're looking at the body of knowledge, that you are accurately representing not just what is there, which is okay, so and so and so and so, these two studies use the same method. Cool. So I should be able to use the same method because they found it was useful. But you also have to substantiate when there's a lack of evidence on something and say, well, there's a hole here. And that's actually a really common thing that people do in research where they're like, this is a space in the body of research that is thin or absent or underrepresented from these angles or whatever it might be, right? Like you have to, that's even part of your claim, right? Is, oh, my stuff is important to the body of research because of X, right? Now, one of the things you said earlier on, though, I want to go back to is you said that, and we're not bashing on that paper, we're just using it as an example. But you said that their prompts were librarian-esque, and they basically just looked like the wiki article. So, in your mind, when you were assessing that research, why did that show up as a red flag for you?
That's interesting. The one aspect is that there are certain areas where there are known hallucinations. There are scant or less codified areas of knowledge, meaning that training data doesn't exist or it hasn't been normalized or there aren't rich semantic sources for that data. We know that Wikipedia exists. We know these certain areas where there's strengths. We know that academic libraries, for example, are very semantic and exist as like one of the foundations of the internet. And so the questions, the prompts that there were five prompts that were based, the basis, those five prompts became the basis for the 100% claim, which is a very dangerous claim. Those five prompts were in areas where AI doesn't struggle.
Oh, I see. Okay. So you're talking about they basically stacked the deck in their favor, right? So they took something that is already known to be very, very high quality.
Yes. And it's like if you the thing is that this is just me, but if you form a hypothesis or you want to make a claim or to research how to reduce hallucinations, even going as far as 100%, is that you obviously are going to want to look and say this area there we have an idea of that of the percentage of accuracy in certain domains or subject areas with AI.
Well,
There was
it's baseline.
That was absent. There was
It's like,
no baseline. There was no baseline.
there's no baseline. And then it's also, if like back to distribution, like talking about information literacy, p values. How many people know what a p value is? How many people know what statistical significance means, and if it's stated, if it's actually significant or not. Like these are things like hardcore researchers have to do all the time, but you're, and I don't even want to say like your average person, but like even people that are knowledge workers that are constantly looking at research articles, there is such a glutton and a huge amount of information coming at you all the time. How often do even the very, high degree researchers who really know their p value stuff, unless you really, really look closely, are you going to catch it? And that's the scary thing, is because
And
we're
you know
constantly looking at stuff.
what's so interesting? So my daughter's a psychology major at University of Oregon. She's midway through her degree. And what was fascinating, she's taking a statistical research course. And so they have a corpus basically of statistical values. And she set out to write a paper on trying to confirm that people that post a lot on social media or influencers are narcissistic. And that was her paper. And sadly, she wasn't able to draw the correlation statistically. Didn't confirm her hypothesis. And that's okay. That's the other part of it. Like we set out because lots of people think that social media followership or, or being an influencer means that, that you might be narcissist. People say throw that all the time. Kudos. Like there's also nothing wrong with being like I was wrong. That's the thing. Like, you stretch your research to confirm your bias, to cherry pick, for example. Cherry picking is very, very common.
Yeah, and you know, something else that is it's discussed a lot, but I don't think anyone has really come up with a solution. And that is not enough research articles are published when they fail.
Right.
That's useful. It's really helpful to see where someone failed. And so I've seen a lot of people say, well, you know, then what's the significance? It's not going to get a lot of citations because it failed. And it's like, well, that shouldn't be the reason you're publishing it. So I have seen a lot of people publishing their lab notes where, you know, there are failures for certain, you know, factors that they put into their study, but then they fix it for the, you know, they find a solution for it and they comment on that in the final paper. But like the true failures don't actually get the same recognition, but at least it's getting out there. I know there's a lot of preprints and things that people are also putting out or blog posts on their methodology as they were doing their experiment. So things like that are really helpful, but and now I'm getting like so far afield, but it's fun when that happens in these conversations. What about the linked data that could connect all those artifacts together?
And
That doesn't exist.
that's exactly it. My dream, if I were just a librarian, was to, and I did go this route for a bit, is scholarly communications. It is an amazing area of librarianship, and its intent is to open up the channels of communication between institutions in order to share knowledge. And people end up repeating research, each other's research. The reason why research is important is because it builds upon each other's research. Like, we shouldn't be repeating each other's discoveries or experiments or whatever.
But I'll push back slightly on that because I agree, but I also think there are different interpretations because each human is different, right? So is the study exactly the same? I think the probability of that is on the lower side, but I see your point,
You
but I
need
also
the communication channel in order to know, and there's nothing wrong with repeating the experiment, for example, or the research, but I have a different approach. I think your approach was not correct, right? And that's fair, but communication's really important. I see that being lost in general, just in research. Like, when you have scholars or researchers able to share notes and information, it's beautiful. And so linked data in terms, we see that with DOI. That's a form of data. So the DOI, the identifier, that's a URI pattern. That's the permanent identifier that helps to base to lend authority to that research, right? So the scholarly publication has a stamp that says, yes, this is a legitimate piece of scholarly
But
communication.
that's where I was going with my point too, is though, like when you have lab notes and you have a blog, they don't have DOIs, and maybe they have other
True.
IDs that can be linked to that DOI, but how many people are actually doing that, right? It kind of gets buried in the shuffle of other things, you know. Like I'm always, you know, when I say shuffle of other things, I'm thinking of my professors that before digitization and doing everything online was like incredibly popular. Yes, I am that old for those watching. That sounds like I'm ancient, but yeah. I'm older than Google. A lot of us are hopefully watching this. But they would have all these stacks of papers and books and other things on their desk. And I remember one of my professors, he had such a small office that when you went in to talk to him, he had to like look over his books that were in front of him. All of his lab's notes were everywhere. And it's like, yeah, how much knowledge was lost from that? Just like the mess of stuff.
True. It's true. And you know what's interesting is I just got a book. I went to the bookstore yesterday and I got this great book. I wish it was in my room right now that I'm in. But the interesting thing was the citations, the index in the back of the book was not a traditional index. It was the first time I've seen this, where it was divided between scholarly peer-reviewed papers, and there was a section. And then you turned and it was like, non-scholarly peer-reviewed papers. Blogs was another section, and every single one had a URL or an HTTP, so it was a URI permalink and a QR code.
There
were big words. And I was like, this is an interesting approach.
Yeah, that is
Right?
interesting. I've never seen that.
I've never seen that either, but I thought it was interesting. I'm all for traditional indexes or non-traditional indexes, but the fact that it was so approachable because of everything existing, it was a very non-paper way in a paper book of thing, how do we codify knowledge and build, and have those reference points. I mean, it's the reference aspect.
Well, and back to the original point too of like, how do you know something is evidence-based? How do you know the evidence is strong enough, right? Like court of law or whatever it might be. Give me your evidence and it has to be convincing and it has to be enough. Well, if you now can prove like from the babyhood of the idea through all the trials and tribulations and all the other things to the thing that it grows into that is then peer-reviewed and published and beautiful, like what a cool chain of custody that is, right? Like the provenance of that. It, again, I'm not naive. I know that's not always possible, and I know that's not always useful. But I think that the thought of understanding all the nuances and the path that you take to learning is something that, especially in the knowledge graph space, especially with agentic AI is now like the thing everybody's talking about, and causal graphs. Thank you, Amy, for cluing me into that one. That I think is like starting to get teased out more, and maybe not just on the scholarship side, but more like R&D, because a lot of the corporate folks are doing this. But that is so fascinating to me because that's what makes us human, like how you learn, and we learn in starts and stops, and it gets really messy, and you go off on a tangent, and somehow it brings you back with like this new found knowledge of something that's really cool that you could do. And that's the beauty of learning, and it's
Well, that's the
so
thing. It's
cool.
like a learning framework. I mean, that's part of what research is it follows like a learning framework that I feel like is getting lost. And I don't want to be snobby or super esoteric or like the high and lofty, like academic up in the tower, but we have to have standards.
We need some standards. So, okay, Jess, what are some of the standards that you see are lacking in some, and let's stay away from just the publications, but just people
Sure.
making claims in general. Like, what are some of those things that you're seeing?
Citations, 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 citations. Like, know how to cite your sources. And come out of the gate hot with some sort of claim. People are impressionable. And the way media and the race to AI success is going, we seem to be leaving some of these standards by the wayside. So just like when anyone, we've all, if you think of your high school experience and your college experience, like you maybe you could pass go without with only citing Wikipedia. That's fine. But like usually there's a paradigm and there's a framework for citations and how you surface reliably, how you can substantiate your claims.
Well, and even and how outdated is the claim? If you're making this great claim today, but you founded it on data that's over 10 years old. And again, don't get me wrong, like if you're in the history space, then 10 years is not much at all. But like, if you're in medical, 10 years is a lot of time that you're not taking into consideration. So what happened? So that's one of the other ones that I've seen is, people are not necessarily looking at the distribution of time represented in their
Right, that's true.
research.
That's a great point. You don't see a fair distribution. Sometimes you see everything's within the past year. And I think a lot of people will probably ask, well, but AI's so new. How could you expect
It's so
Ashley?
new. The thing we know right now is new, but no, it's been around.
Exactly. And that's the other misnomer. So it's really interesting because like we start to get into this misinformation, disinformation world.
Like
And
even like
we're, yeah.
it's so, again, it's not surprising to me. Like unless you work in semantics or computer science, or you've been working with the internet and other things for quite some time, or you're a historian of, cyber stuff. LLMs have been around, I think, since what, the 1960s or something?
Yeah.
Like in the basis of them, right? But the
Right.
power, the thing that we can see now, has only come up to pass because, the chips and the power needed and getting more efficiencies, and there's like all these other things that go into like why now. But yeah, these things have, like, even on my own channel, go back and, like, I think it's like a month or two before the OpenAI ChatGPT thing like really went crazy. I have a video on my channel talking about these. Like, it wasn't a new thing. But that, like, even that, a lot of people miss. And so there's this understanding that, well, this is the newest thing, and if I'm not doing this thing, then I'm outdated, when in reality, there's a lot of other types of AI or machine
A lot of
statistical
other
machine learning that
a
is
lot of
much
other
lower on cost and processing power and other things, and those have dominated in the years past because they didn't need all of that orchestration and all the other things that the Gen AI needs right now. So it's not to say those things aren't still useful. It's all, and I'm a big fan of talking about this, is just because you can doesn't mean you should, right? So that's not saying I'm one of the naysayers about AI. Of course not. I work in AI. Like, I have lots of things on this channel about LLMs and Gen AI and all those things. But sometimes you can use a more simplistic approach. It's just
Nothing
so
wrong
easy to use AI to
with
do it now. That's the problem.
that because it's more accessible and it's coming
Yeah.
to the commons. And I think that's, that we can all touch and feel it. It used to be something where it was like,
Yeah.
okay, collaborating with this machine learning team and we're using
Yeah,
BERT.
that's so
I'm
true.
going to throw some NLP in there. And it was just sort of this homegrown sort of, it was normal. It
Yeah.
wasn't abnormal, but now it's like everyone can touch and feel it. Anyone can build a prompt, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
We start to make a science out of every aspect of it. And that's where I think I see that interesting intersection. If we're making a science out of prompting, we're making a science out of, how what our stack looks like. Are you using a property graph or a knowledge graph? Are you using NLP? Are you using vectors? Are you using,
Yeah.
sort of like, there becomes these this, and I always equate this to building the railroad, is who's going to put the golden spike in? Who's going to crack that nut and figure out like what it takes to make it work at a lower cost, high
Yeah.
efficiency, 100% accuracy back to that original paper. There's no such thing as 100%.
Well,
It's
I
just
would love to know which human is 100% accurate. Let's start there, because if the AI is able to do it at 100% accuracy, I would love to see which human agrees with that. Right? Like, that's
exactly.
the actual
I would
problem.
hope it doesn't. I would hope it doesn't. And that's the thing is like it's the use case specific. That's what's so interesting about research though, is that it helps us to understand the different approaches and different lenses. Back to that, like, where we have scholarly communication, there can be like a million different approaches to the same problem. We know that. We were talking about cleaning offline, and it's like your method for cleaning and my method for cleaning may be totally different, but in the end, we both have a clean house.
Very clean house.
Right?
Yeah. Well, and I think that that's a really good point, and I think that that is maybe a good place to kind of end all of this on too, is there are many ways to do things, but not every way is the most efficient, and not every way is the most transparent in how they were done, right? So yes, you can go to many different mechanics to get your car worked on. But you're probably going to go to the one that has a higher reputation, that you can trust, that you know is going to get it done in an efficient manner at lower the lowest cost for the quality you're going to get, right? Like, this is just how decision making works. And I think that at the end of the day, in my mind, and this is like my closing remark, and I'll pass it over to Jess, you have to be transparent in how you're doing your study. And if you are, even if it's a crappy study, okay, maybe you cannot do that reproducibility, which is so important to research.
That's a great.
But maybe it was still really important, and you just have to be transparent in what you did, and that is what happened, and it can't be reproduced. Okay.
Well, That's important, the reproducibility. And that's something that again, yes.
As long as you are transparent about all of it, though. And I think that's the part that's missing in some of these things is you see the big headline, but you don't see the fine print. And even the fine print that is shown isn't always as forthright as you would need it to be to then, and this is what my closing piece is, to make decisions on. You need the data so you can make a decision on it. So you see this study, you see this blog, you see, this lab note. Is there enough detail there for you to make an informed decision? Because you can make a bad decision and you can say, look, I loved that research that they did and they said 100% accuracy. I want to buy into that. That's your decision to make, but you need to make sure as the researcher that there's enough information for people to make an informed decision.
Yes, yo, and that's exactly it. Like reading one paper or finding one instance is oftentimes not enough to substantiate a claim from a research perspective, research best practices. So that's absolutely 100% correct. And, I want to build off of that and what you just said for my remark. So, aside from that, when you proliferate, like you may not realize how powerful your voice or your influence
So
is.
true.
And so when you proliferate that chain of misinformation in any sort of way, or you don't substantiate the claim in an authentic way where you can point out like where there might be flaws, there's nothing wrong with that. That's the thing. Dialogue and critical thinking are both super important for information literacy and AI literacy for that matter. Ultimately, to that point, we're looking at how AI can help humans. I mean, it's a tool for humans. And so it's in our best interest to be a little more critical about research and looking at the sources. Again, I just want to emphasize, like looking at the sources, look at the hypothesis, look at what the data, what the breadth or depth of the data is, what's the distribution of the data that's included, not even getting into p values or anything like that. But doing your fair share of work, just because someone's published research, you still have a role as the consumer of that research.
And I think that the those who are creating that research, like I said, they can't make those decisions unless the data is there for them and that it's accurately represented. Sometimes you have the best intentions and you still like don't say it the way that you would think about it. You and I maybe think about this in a different way than what the researchers were looking at. I find that is often the case, like especially like knowledge engineer kind of people, that are working with ontologies and things, data centric people. Oftentimes when dealing with machine learning and AI folks, again, they're also data people. Of course they are, but I have noticed there is. It's more the forest from the trees, and then people like us are more like trees and then forest, right? So
Yeah.
looking at the same thing, it's just like the perception is
Different
little
lens.
different.
And
Then that might be the case.
that's what's so nice is like we need all the perspectives, but oftentimes we're in such a rush to get to some end goal or to declare some victory or to own a space or to successes. And a lot of times research is required to, for example, at work to get an initiative approved, it needs to be founded upon research and claims and testing, A/B tests, and so when you and hypotheses, we all, I mean, we live in a world of hypotheses. I think if that, then that, if that, then why? And yeah, I mean, you can't build an argument without the data, without information, without the sources. And if there are no sources, and you're the first one, congratulations, invite others into the space because you're not going to be the last one.
Well, and that's the thing to keep in mind too is you can make a hypothesis, it can be peer reviewed, you can have as much detail as you have in front of you, but all of us are only able to assert things based on what's in front of us and our current knowledge as a person, as a group, as a society. At one point, there was a hypothesis the world was flat, and a whole lot of really smart people believed it. And
Yep.
now we
And
know it's not true.
people still believe it. That's the danger.
Well, there's that. There is that. But I mean, the point, right, is, well, now we have more evidence. We have other things that we know that we're like, oh, that's not so true. So that's the other point of all of this is your evidence. There's a great book called I think it's called The Half-Life of a Fact, or
I've read that. Yes.
Yeah. And it's that's what that's about is, you know, there's all of this research. There's so much stuff going on. And it's true in a point of time, but it does have half-life because everything is constantly changing and we're discovering more things and we're understanding things at a deeper level. And so that's just to keep in mind for everyone listening, like that's, you can't just take one thing and just set it and forget it. You got to keep digging in. You got to keep understanding how can I rip this thing apart and really get under the hood and really understand it, because to Jess's point, you could be the one that really like cracks the code on whatever it might be. But if you don't use those critical thinking skills and you just take that one article or those, you know, 50 articles or whatever it is, and that's what you run with the rest of your life, it's going to get outdated. You're going to get outdated. You're going to start to do misinformation that you might not even realize you're doing, right? So, you know, there's a timeliness to all of it.
All right. And I want to thank Jessica again for jumping on and talking through some of the things that she's been seeing in the industry. If you yourself have seen any of these, like I said, leave the comments down below and we can have an open discussion, which is another topic that Jessica brought up. So with that, I want to thank you very much and I'll catch you next time.